Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
And you're just a summer fling, like the autumn leaves you've changed, and the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you. And the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? The Salty Dogs have released 3 full-length studio albums and a recent EP, and have played countless shows sharing the stage with Pete Anderson, David Rawlings, Kinky Friedman, Kelly Willis, and many more. Their music has been featured on TLC's hit show Trading Spaces and on the award-winning Sundance Channel hit show Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Oyster Bar in Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and tonight's show is sponsored by River Rock Realty Company, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my left here playing his 1931 national resonator is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist. So tonight's featured artist is Little Rock multimedia artist Candy Jones, who is also one of our storytellers tonight. And our feature... And our featured piece is this piece right here, kind of right behind me, entitled Summer, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Candy at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our writers all find themselves strangers in a strange land. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Candy Jones goes looking for a good time in another city and makes a classic tourist mistake. And we'll end the night with Bill Scott's Overseas and In Over His Head in translation. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Don Taylor as he tries to make a buck in a strange place in Walla Walla Willie.
It was on one of the journeys of my youth. The wind was my travel agent. My thumb pointed at my general destination. Easy come, easy go, then homesickness. Hit you in the stomach like a sucker punch. But there I was on the streets of Seattle, Washington, ready to go home with my tail tucked between my legs and no means to get there. Analyzing the audit of my return to Arkansas fund, the balance had not risen much farther than zero. I was directly aligned on an opposite coast from a year or two earlier. I noticed these people in New York City. That's back before there was crack, meth, and all that, and back before there were gangs, back before the word homeless was even a word. But there was these mysterious street people, and I was quite fascinated. I thought it was a lifestyle choice, and I was curious. I didn't know it then, but within 18 months, I'd be among these people on the opposite coast. His name was Walla Walla Willie, or at least that's the name I gave him. His story was he'd come home from work early one day because he'd been ill and caught his wife in bed with her preacher. Not to make a long story out of this part, but the wife dies of a gunshot wound. Preacher becomes a short-legged big-shoed preacher. And Willie gets a 30-year stint at Walla Walla Prison in Washington State. Now retired from his correctional career, he would reside upon the benches late at night at Seattle's Pioneer Square. Now, Willie, he was a connoisseur of screw cap wine. Port was his expertise. He showed me how to savor the corner of wine. That's when you done drank the whole bottle and you turn it at 45 degrees and you get this triangulation of wine in the bottom. And you hold it away from your body and you take just a moment to appreciate what you've done and then slam it down. Well, Willie thought I was the greatest because I'd always come up with another $2 to get another bottle. At this point, I had to tell him, you know, I'm all tapped out. Then I asked him, I wonder where a guy could get some work around here. And he said, there's this bus that shows up about 4:30 every morning over there by the Gessler. They get off and they come back with money, he said. So the next morning, a few hours later, I'm standing in front of the Gessler Hotel, which had accommodations that the rats complain about. And sure enough, these two buses showed up. Not having an understanding of the protocol, immediately there's this great rush for the first bus that caught me flat-footed. Left me with the shufflers boarding the second bus. It was still dark, and it's a foggy northwest, and the streets of Seattle were soon distant. Pretty soon, this little skinny white guy stood up in front of the bus, and he said there'd be no drinking, smoking, or even feeling good until we get to work. I look over my right, already there's one guy, he's unscrewing his little bottle, and another guy's rolling smoke. And after a long while, the bus came to a halt. Me and my fellow indigents, we filed off, and there stood that little guy with a clipboard, asking our names, and I don't know why I said Barstow Daggett. It was quite light, but not quite dark. There was this thing out in the field. Couldn't quite make it out. It kind of looked like an aircraft in its landing approach. With all its lights, and before I knew it, all these guys took off running for those lights out there. Well, I was young, quite surprised. I passed them all, blowing through them like a Kenyan in the old drunk 5K. I broke the tape. I'm standing before this behemoth of a tractor with two long appendages sticking out from each side. And upon each appendage, it was like eight ironing boards. And they perched about a foot above the ground. Pretty soon, second, third, fourth, eighth plates came in. And they started jumping on the ironing boards. And so I jumped on one, too. 17th, 18th, 19th, they came in. And they had to get a bucket and walk behind. Now, it was really getting light out. I could kind of tell what was going on. There was this valley surrounded by mountains. This wet fog of the Pacific Northwest was kind of clinging to the side of the hills. And before me, there was this expanse of green row crops. Well, I kind of figured it out. We were fixing to pick something. With the team assembled, the track started to move. And I remember the girl driving the tractor saying, remember, no bigger than your hand, you got to get the little ones. The tractor started gliding at half a mile an hour over this humongous cucumber field. He had to grab the little ones, stuff them in this hole underneath your ironing board, and the little pickles would go up this conveyor belt and drop into this big container on the tractor. Once in a while, someone on the ironing board would fall asleep. His arm be dragging through the crops, and guys with the buckets would shout him out, and the first one to notice would get to replace him. Anyway, I was steadily stuffing these little pickles in the hole. And I don't know if you've ever picked cucumbers in any quantity. You don't want to do this without gloves. My hands were shredded. They're one spiny vegetable. With my hands hurting, feeling really awful, this land craft came to a halt. And up drove a truck. It's one of those kind of stainless steel concessions trucks with a big pot of stew on board. They served it up in styrofoam cups. And I was slamming them down as fast as they could fill them. I hadn't eaten in days. On the other side of the stand, you could get gloves and other things. So after consuming several cups of this delicious stew, I had a warm belly, a pair of rubber gloves, and it was all there for the taking. I was so grateful. The rest of the day was much easier. At the end of the day, the bus pulls back up, and we all got in line. The same old skinny white man with a clipboard was going down the line. He said to me, Daggett, Barstow, you ate eight cups of stew and bought a pair of gloves. Ready to pay $25, you get $3.50. It was a long bus ride back to Seattle. I was nursing my wounds, but savoring that bottle of beer they gave each of us. So that evening, I was explaining to Walla Walla Willie what I'd gone through and what they'd done to me, and he said, you got paid how much? I said, $3.50. He looked at me, grinned, he said, I got 50 cents. That's two bottles. We good.
Don't John Taylor is a part-time writer, videographer, and full-time maintenance man who hails from Batesville, Arkansas, where he lives with his partner, both creative and domestic, Julie M. Fiddler, and four feline Americans. Next on Tales from the South, Candy Jones goes to party and ends up leaving with less than she came with in I Can't Get No Satisfaction.
It was a beautiful fall evening, and the partiers were plentiful as I parked my minivan on the street by the infamous Peabody Hotel in downtown Memphis. My friend Sandra and I had driven over from Marion, Arkansas, when our historic preservation conference banquet and auction were finally over. Feeling adventurous, we were headed for Beale Street. To be on the safe side, Sandra and I each took our cash, the amount we had allotted ourselves, for a night of revelry, and locked our purses in the car, along with conference liquor leftovers and purchased art. We were in Memphis on Beale Street without teenage kids, away from our jobs, away from our everyday responsibilities, and precious Southern gentlemen just kept buying us little old cocktails. My memory of the next few hours are a bit of a haze. Wild and crazy dancing from bar to bar on Beale Street. We were not sober. But I do remember very well, I might add, what happened next, because the adventure was about to begin. We were giggling our way back to the van when we saw it. The side window was busted out. I was paralyzed for a brief moment. They probably took the liquor out of the bag. We checked. All the leftover liquor was intact. So was the art I had purchased at the auction. I think we both realized it at the same time. Our purses were gone. We were frantic. It was after 2 a.m. We had about $8 between us, and we were staying at a hotel back in Marion. There had been a police station on Beale Street, but after careful deliberation, we thought it was in our best interest not to walk into the police station in our present inebriated state. Then we decided the thieves had probably just taken our billfolds and thrown our purses away. So like the fools we were, we ventured out determined to find our purses. We searched every dipsy dumpster in a 3-block area. We tore through bushes. Suddenly we heard words. Words coming from one of the porta-johns behind a fence, aligning the shrubbery we were pillaging. Seemed two people were engaged in extracurricular activities. Gross! In a porta-john. Okay, that was it. We definitely time to give up the search. It was almost 4 a.m. when we returned to our room. Sandra called her husband, who told us a police report would have to be filed. We tried to rest. Each of us kept spouting off our purse contents that we would miss. Sandra had lost a Coach designer purse. Finally, we drifted off to sleep. At some point, I shot straight up in the bed and yelled at Sandra, I had 13 Rolling Stones tickets in my purse. I was suddenly very sick to my stomach. My friends had entrusted me to secure tickets for the Rolling Stones tour coming to War Memorial Stadium back home in Little Rock. $715 worth of really good tickets I had waited in line for hours to purchase for a sold-out concert. The next morning, we ventured back to the Beale Street Police Station, which was housed in a wonderful old historic building. The sergeant's desk at the entrance was a huge antique that looked as though it once seated a judge towering over the courtroom. Sandra, being much taller than I, had to stand on tippy toes to see the lady sergeant behind the desk. I could hardly reach the top of the desk, let alone see over it. A short, chubby, hungover jack-in-the-box, bouncing up and down to get a glimpse at the lady sergeant. There was a constant buzz of activity and chatter throughout the open building. Item by item, we conveyed the contents of our purses. Lady Sergeant could have cared less. She showed no emotion, no sympathy, no concern for our plight. When we told her we didn't want to be mugged on Bill Street, so we locked our purses in the car, she did work up one mischievous grin and said, "Oh, really?" And then, during an in-air bounce, I blurted out, "I had 13 Rolling Stones tickets stolen." A hush fell over the entire room. In perfect unison, dozens of folks collectively gave a loud sigh. Oh, filled the substation. They were feeling my pain. Lady Sergeant even showed a tad bit of empathy. At home Monday, we each called our credit card companies and filled out the tedious bank forms to change our entire financial life. Each time I told the story of the Rolling Stones tickets, there was a collective sigh. We discovered multiple charges on each of our accounts. In less than 3 days, the thieves had drained all of mine and Sandra's accounts, and then some, to the total of over $10,000. I sucked it up and notified my friends of my stupidity, here with reassurances that I would pay them all back eventually. I searched for tickets for weeks, 2 or 4 tickets here and there, all at inflator scalper prices. I just couldn't get no satisfaction. Then 1 week before the concert, miracle of miracles occurred. A guy was selling 11 tickets. He had intended to raise the price a tad, but when I relayed my sad, pathetic story, he sold me all 11 tickets at cost. My little heart leapt. The money came from my recovered savings intended for new living room furniture. My priorities had never been straighter. There was no contest between Mick and a couch. To say we were excited the night of the concert is an understatement. Mom had made us dinner of fried chicken and potato salad, and we were planning on an early arrival at War Memorial Stadium for a Rolling Stones tailgating party. Mick serenaded us from the van's speakers. Just as we took the interstate exit for the stadium, one friend asked from the back seat, "You do have the tickets, don't you?" You talk about a girl whipping a car around. I cussed myself out loud all the way back to my Maumelle home. The folks in the car couldn't get a word in edgewise. I had carefully hid the tickets at home because I was not about to keep them in my purse. They ate the chicken en route. We made it to the concert with a few minutes to spare. I tried to catch my breath, but felt compelled to check and see if the original tickets I had purchased were being used. I traipsed my little prissy self over to the section and row of what I thought to be the stolen tickets. With a bit of an attitude, I asked the folks sitting on the end if they realized they were sitting in stolen ticket seats. The poor guy looked up and said, "Lady, we won these tickets on the radio." I slinked away, realizing I had no more remembered where those seats were than I remembered the bars we had attended that infamous night. As the Stones took the stage, huge tears filled my eyes. There we were, my dearest friends, who had graciously reimbursed me for ticket purchases again. Me and Mick. Oh, and a giant blow-up Elvis. You know, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you might find you get what you need.
Candy Jones, the Garage Sale Queen, is an award-winning mixed media artist. She is a frequent guest on KATV and teaches at the Arkansas Arts Center and Eureka Springs School of Arts. An avid storyteller, she speaks all over Arkansas about the art of recycling and has done several readings on Tales from the South. More can be found at garagesalequeen.biz. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Bill Scott travels halfway across the world and the unfamiliar in A Language Barrier.
My biggest concern traveling overseas was the inability to communicate, suddenly becoming the foreigner, or furner, as we say up yonder in the holler. Okay, that's not entirely true. My biggest concern was having to squat over a hole in the floor and poop like a third world refugee. Dan, my then boyfriend and travel companion, said, "It's just a Turkish toilet. It's just a little flesh-eating bacteria. It's just a group of villagers with pitchfork and torches." The difference between me and Dan, for him, everything's going to be fine. For me, everything will be fine when everything is indeed fine. Dan assured me the Turks hadn't invaded Spain, so, butt cheeks firmly clenched, I boarded the plane. Everything was in English. The passengers, the flight attendants, the announcements. I had a drink, relaxed. Several hours later, we began our descent. And magically, everything converted to Spanish. Passengers, announcement, flight attendants. Dear Lord, what have I done? I navigated from the airport to the metro, to the train station, all without speaking to a soul. But lunch was upon me, and if I was going to eat, I'd have to speak to the matador behind the counter at the train station cafe. I eyed the sandwiches displayed inside the glass case, recognized the word queso. I also recognized the word in front of it, not as food, but as a lyric from a Michael Jackson song. Jam on. Because I'm bad, jam on. Jam on, why queso, I said to the matador. In a perfect world, he would have handed me the sandwich without any chit-chat. But no, he began to habla español. You may not have gathered this, but my Spanish is limited. Very limited. Bits of it roll around in my head like bingo numbers in a hopper. I see the word I want, but when the bin opens, you never know which one is going to roll out. On occasion, I have to use a bit of Spanish at work, so most of the words in the hopper pertain to gynecology. And those were the ones trying to make their way out. The matador stared. I opened the door to the hopper. Voy examinarte. I am going to examine you. Relaja sus piernas. Relax your legs. I didn't say it out loud. The hopper door was open, but my mouth was closed. There is a reason bingo is illegal in Arkansas. I pointed to the sandwich, grinned, nodded, and said a simple C. Adios, I said, and immediately felt like a phony. Adios, it seemed like a fake word, cartoonish. In my head, I was that Saturday morning speedy Mexican mouse. Adios, amigos. My thin, slowpoke mouse friend leaning against the wall, cheesy mustache, sombrero over his eyes, and toothpick in his mouth says, si, senor. Sandwiches in hand, we took the high-speed train to Alicante and spent the night at Hotel Silverfish and Ant. The exact name of the hotel was Villa something pretty or other, a misnomer. If I was a naturist, thank Darwin and taxonomy, not middle-aged flabby nudes hanging out in trailer parks, I'd name it for the wildlife roaming its rooms, Silverfish and Ant. Staying there was akin to being in one of those drive-through zoos where the animals have free range and you're trapped in your car. Only without the car. The next morning, I got online and found a hotel in the heart of Alicante, Hospice Amerigo. Someone in the near vicinity must have been living, right? Because I got the room for less than half price. I eloped that morning while Dan was off on a work-related expedition. Perhaps I'd been unduly influenced by the burlap sheets and cinder black walls of Stalag, Silverfish, and Ant, but Hospice Amerigo was muy bueno. The best hotel room I'd ever stayed in. I felt like an Alicante prince. When I heard the pitter-patter of little feet in the bathroom ceiling, I tried to convince myself it was a Spanish leprechaun hiding its gold. And not a family of rats eating through the wiring. When I heard a muffled, si, senor, come from the ceiling, I looked at the marble floors, the separate sitting area, and convinced myself I was hearing things. The following morning, while I was comfortably ensconced in El Paradiso de Homo, Dan left to give a lecture, the purpose of our trip. I hadn't plans for the day, then realized I'd left my dental floss at Silverfish and Ant. So I headed out in search of floss. As good of a way as any to see Alicante on foot. I found numerous groceritas. I made that word up, grocerita, small grocery store. None of which had dental floss. I finally went into Farmacia, where I found floss locked in a glass display case. I soon found out why. It was 4.73 euros, which came out to $6.77. $6.77 for waxy string. I used the pharmaceutical-grade torture string, then translated the words on the package. Conflor, y menta, horsehair and thistle. The thistle really gets your gums a-bleeding, purging the vile dental humors from your body. The horsehair has natural coagulants, ensuring a nice, dense scab forms along the gum line. Pretty. By the end of the week, I imagined my teeth would be fully protected behind an impenetrable wall of scab, and all for only 4.73 euros. I desperately needed to soak my gums in a numbing agent. Having just been robbed by Farmacia, I was forced to make certain economic concessions. Wine in bars and restaurants was muy expensivo. But you could buy an entire bottle in a grocerita for super cheap. You could get a nice red for about 10 meters of dental floss. 2 bottles in tow, Dan and I hopped the train to Madrid, our next destination. Our apartment in the Chueca Barrio had a stock kitchenette, but no wine opener. So while Dan was on a conference call, I went out in search of El Corkscrew. I found multiple groceritas, all of which had wine, none of which had El Corkscrew. How hard would it be to hang corkscrews from the same rack? Not very. At my 4th stop, I mimed corkscrew to the senora behind the counter. She shook her head, pointed down the street, and rattled off some Spanish. In it, I thought I discerned the word for corkscrew, chupacabra. I headed out in search of El Chupacabra. I found El Chupacabra in a hardware store, crouched above a deep fryer in between a pair of scissors and a spool of ribbon, Organization Madrid style. I had the corkscrew, but now realized I was lost. Chueca is a drunken grid of acute and obtuse angles, leaving the geographically impaired me forever disoriented. I finally wandered into an area where almost everything was in English. Leather bar, sauna for men, sex shop, Vegetarianos Cucina, 3 out of 4, not bad. I still didn't know where I was, but it was beginning to feel like home. It was early February, the sun was setting, and I needed to get back before dark. The neighborhood wasn't dangerous, but the streets were poorly lit, and the sidewalks were thick with dog crap. I spotted a beacon of hope. The first sign of spring. A man in leather chaps and harness. Goosebumps on the buttocks mean 6 more weeks of winter. Stubble means summer's just around the corner. Aware of my navigational limitations, I'd snapped a photo of our residence facade before I left the apartment. I showed the picture to the Spanish groundhog and used my words. Donde? He pointed me home. I was just a block away. Dan and I spent another 4 days navigating the poop-encrusted sidewalks of Madrid. Chueca, Madrid, fantastico. But if you lose your concentration, even for a second, you'll find yourself sliding down the calle at warped speed. Dan would try to warn me with, "Watch out, there's a big," or "Be careful, you're about to." He never failed to get my attention, but by the time he got the words out, dog crap was afoot. And I found myself hopping about the sidewalk, high-stepping from one clean patch to the next. Savvy traveler that I am, I instituted a quicker warning system to avoid the doggy-do two-step slip and slide. Short but sweet. Feces! If the Spaniards knew what we were saying, they paid us no mind. 2 Tourette's-riddled Americans strolling through their neighborhood, yelling feces every 20 feet or so. Feces! Feces! The C and Z of Castilian Spanish are pronounced as an English TH, such as Barcelona and Gracias. So feces quickly became feethies. Infinitely more pleasing to the ear. Feethies! And just like that, we were speaking El language.
Bill Scott would like to swim efficiently, bike faster, run pain-free, and write without second-guessing every word. But until such time, he is content to bore you with his silly life stories. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience here at the Oyster Bar in Little Rock, Arkansas, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. Tonight's show is sponsored by River Rock Realty Company. More at liveinlittlerock.com. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Heck of a time at the old folks' home. At the old folks' home, you'll always wear a smile. At the old folks' home. Meals on wheels at the old, yeah. At the old folks home, at the old folks home, you'll always wear a smile, at the old folks home. The old folks home. 22, B49, Hope 22. I'm a feeling fine at the old, at the old folks' home.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.